Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the session on public health workforce development this bright, early, sunny morning on Monday. Nice to see you here. My name is Dr. Bill Keck, and we're here today because we think there are some really important and perhaps even exciting initiatives going on in the area of public health workforce development that we want to share with you this morning. They are related to the core competencies of public health, so we have a panel of four of us this morning. We're going to talk about these a little bit with you and give you a chance to interact with us about them. As part of our panel, we have Dr. Donna Peterson, who is the Dean of the College of Public Health and Senior Associate Vice President at the University of South Florida. She is Editor Emerita of the Maternal and Child Health Journal, founding member and past president of the National Board of Public Health Examiners, chair of the Council on Education for Public Health, and chair-elect of the Association of Schools and Programs of Public Health. And between 2011 and 2015, she chaired the ASPPH-sponsored task force called Framing the Future, the Second 100 Years of Education in Public Health. And of course, she'll be speaking with us about that effort. She's at the end over there. Next, we have Laura Razor King. She's served as the Executive Director of the Council on Education for Public Health since October of 2004. And as Executive Director, she's responsible for managing the work of the organization and supporting the CEF Board of Directors, the organization's policymaking and decision-making body. She provides consultation to universities interested in establishing public health degree programs and pursuing accreditation. And she's responsible for maintaining liaisons with governmental and private sector organizations that share common interests in higher education, accreditation, academic public health, and public health workforce issues. Her areas of experience include quality assurance mechanisms in public health and in higher education in the United States, and she has an interest in higher education quality assurance issues internationally as well. She frequently speaks on these topics and has served as an advisor to colleagues and organizations from several countries that are trying to build internal accreditation systems. And she, of course, will be speaking with us about some of the work going on at CEF. And then next to me is Edward Hunter. Mr. Hunter joined the DeBaumont Foundation as president and chief executive officer in February of 2015. He's had a long and distinguished career in public health, most recently having served as director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Washington office. As a principal CDC spokesperson to Congress, the administration, and public health organizations, Mr. Hunter was a leading voice for the nation's preeminent public health and scientific research programs. And as a member of the CDC's senior leadership, Mr. Hunter directed their legislative strategy and gained valuable insight into public health programs, the intersection of policy and science, and the role of partnerships. Prior to his work at CDC's Washington office, he was associate director of the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics, where he was responsible for strategic planning for some of the nation's leading health information systems and helping policymakers use complex data in setting health policy and designing programs to improve the population's health. He'll be telling you about some of the work going on at DeBaumont. Of course, I can tell you that none of us have any financial relationships to disclose.
No money, no relationship.
Well, yes. This is an APHA requirement for sessions, so we have it on the record that none of us stand to gain by any financially by anything we say today. So what we intend to do today is to tell you a little bit about these initiatives. And I'll start with a little bit about the competencies for public health professional workers. But then we'll be talking about how these initiatives align and build upon one another. And then there will be, I hope, plenty of time for interaction with all of you. So we'll ask you to please not be shy in asking questions. Okay, so that's who you'll be hearing from today. Before we start, I want to give a little bit of a shout out to the Public Health Foundation. Its executive director, Ron Bialik, is sitting here, and we have several staff members, Janelle Nichols up front and Kathleen Amos in the back. Point them out because the Public Health Foundation staffs the Council on Linkages and, of course, is very involved in a variety of public health workforce issues. We're all better off for their existence, presence, and good work. And welcome you, I actually encourage you to visit their website if you're not familiar with them to get a sense of the opportunities they have to help you improve your efforts to develop public health workforce. So I'm here in my capacity as chair of the Council on Linkages between Academia and Public Health Practice. I want to tell you just a little bit about that organization and the core competencies. I'm certainly not going to read to you the mission of the Council. It's there on the screen for you. I do want to point out that the Council is made up of representatives from 20 national public health organizations, all listed there. That number seems to be slowly but steadily growing. And we therefore really have an extensive partnership in the work that we do. Now, the core competencies are really just a set of skills that were set to paper, really, that we think indicates those skills that are part and parcel of the broad practice of public health. We think they do reflect the characteristics that staff of public health organizations may want to possess as they move on to protect and promote health. And, well, perhaps most importantly, want you to understand that from our perspective, the core competencies serve as a starting point for practice and academic organizations to look at their own needs and to build specifics into whatever core competency development they want to pursue. But we hope that the competency list we put together will get you started. The core competencies have 8 domains that are listed there. That hasn't changed over time. And now we have 3 tiers, that is 3 levels of competency, say the lower level for frontline staff, a middle level for program management, and a higher level for senior management and executives. These have been in development and have been massaged for quite some time. They really started earlier than 2001 with earlier work of the Public Health Foundation was involved in. But it was in 2001 that the Council on Linkages developed and approved its first set. Now, these were somewhat intentionally set up to be difficult to measure. We were concerned about having people think that perhaps we were trying to set standards for practice. We were not comfortable at that point believing that we were close enough to having that happen. And we also knew that the field evolved fairly rapidly and steadily, and so we made the decision that it would be important as a council to revisit the competencies at a minimum of every 3 years. By revisiting, I mean to review and decide whether they were still appropriate or whether they should be revised. And as you can see, it took us 9 years before we said, well, now it's time to revise them. And so we did that, and at this point did develop the 3 different tiers, did make the competencies a bit more measurable, and once they were in place, then decided the work we should do at that point then was to develop tools that would help people find ways to make use of the competencies. So we invite you again to go to the Public Health Foundation website, and you'll find a list of tools available there. Of course, the tool development has never stopped. It was not that much longer, just 3 or 4 years later, that we decided, after another 3 years, that they indeed should be revised once again. And we then got involved in a very extensive process to get to the edition that's now available for you. That review started in March of 2013, lasted more than a year. engaged, of course, all our council member organizations, the core competencies work group members, because we have a group of probably 50 or 55, I think, now, who are working on these competencies, and other professionals and organizations. Actually, we put out a call on the web and asked for input. We got over 1,000 responses to this. People were very interested and involved and concerned. And so it took time for all of that to occur and for us to respond to the suggestions and questions that we received. But in a little over a year after we started, we then thought we had the final, at least current version. The council agreed and adopted them in June of 2014, and shortly thereafter that version has been released, and it's available on the web. Looks like this, three tiers. I'm sure many of you have seen it, but if you haven't, please go there to take a look at it. Well, who uses these? We have done some work. ASTO surveyed state health departments, and they said over 60% of state health departments use the core competencies. NACHO surveyed local health departments a couple of years ago. They said about a quarter of local health departments are using them. And 8 or 9 years ago, CEF reported to us that over 90% of academic public health programs were using the competencies in one way or another. And we know they're also been used by the CDC, by HRSA, certainly the Public Health Foundation's TRAIN program and its affiliates. They're part of Healthy People 2020. They're used by the Public Health Accreditation Board and a variety of others. And these are the kinds of things they're used for. Job descriptions, performance objectives, performance reviews and evaluation, etc., on down the list. And see more recently preparing for accreditation, the FAB standards and measures, particularly domain 8 in that process. So these are some of the tools that are available online if you would like to see them. We have crosswalked the 2014 and 2010 core competencies. So those of you who were very engaged in using the 2010 competencies and might now be concerned about a new version, this should help you make the transition. We've crosswalked them with the essential public health services. We have self-assessment instruments there that you might find useful. There are some examples of job descriptions using them, workforce development plans, frequently asked questions, so on, and some examples of how they've been used. So, as I said, go to the Public Health Foundation website and you can find more information about the both competencies themselves, the tools. And if you really want to keep up to date with what's going on with the Council on Linkages, just talk to Kathleen or Janelle here or Ron.
We actually have a sign-up sheet going around.
Uh-huh. Thanks. Right. Good. There is a sign-up sheet then. Good. At the back. We have a Council on Linkages update, which is an email newsletter. Comes out, I don't know, 4 or 5 times a year, I guess, depending on 10. All right. 10 times a year. And so that way you can keep up on new occurrences from the Council. And if you have any questions, of course, email us. Okay. Well, with that, then, I'd like to ask Dr. Peterson, if you would.
Thank you, Dr. Keck. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Thanks for coming out on a Monday. But this is an important topic, so we're very, very glad you're here. So I'm going to share a little bit about the task force that was created by the Association of Schools Programs of Public Health. I saw Rita Kelleher and Sarah Weiner come in, wave. They're from ASPPH, so ask them anything you want to know about ASPPH. So this task force was created in the fall of 2011, and as was mentioned earlier, ASPPH had put together a set of competencies for the MPH, and then there were some content areas within the MPH. We had DRPH competencies, and we were at the point where they needed to be reviewed. We were also at the point where we were looking at the growth of undergraduate programs, and sort of all these things were hitting us at the same time, and we thought, well, it might be a good opportunity to just take a step back and look at the whole thing anew. So we created the task force. We were also we also keyed into the fact that we were approaching the 100th anniversary of the Welsh Rose Report, so that seemed like a good opportunity. So we really did try to look at this fresh. We took an empty room approach. We considered every aspect of the educational spectrum. We've created the task force. We had expert panels that worked on different topical areas. We presented anywhere we could get on the agenda. I did town halls wherever anyone would invite me. I just needed an audience and a microphone, and we would have great conversations. We put a web page up where we posted everything. And that work actually concluded in March of this year. So over the course of that 3.5-ish years, we had expert panels on all of these areas. So again, we looked at what was happening in the undergrad world. We addressed the MPH. We looked at the role of community colleges. We re-looked at the DRPH. We considered both interprofessional education across the health professions, but then we also addressed how other professionals' work impacts public health. And that became that expert panel. And we also had an employer group, so that the task force was quite large, and it included a number of our employer partners, but it didn't include all of them. And instead of making the task force even larger, we convened a group of employers, and their opinions informed the work of all of these committees, as did all of the town halls, all the conversations, all the responses we got to questions on the webpage. And near the end of our work, and I have to thank my colleagues at ASS, though. They said, you know what, you've addressed, you know, very well the pre-professional side of the house, but you haven't addressed the post-professional side. And we would hate to see this effort end without some discussion of what are the ongoing needs of professionals in the workforce, those who received public health training as pre-professionals, and those who did not. And so we said, that's a great idea. And so we did this, in essence, to put a stake in the ground and say, yes, this is part of the continuum of education, and it's something that that we need to acknowledge. This was sort of late in the game, so we didn't spend a lot of time fooling around with how we were going to do this. We used the model that we had used in earlier reports, because that just made it easy. And we had to put a box around what we wanted to talk about. And the workforce is huge, right? And depending on how you view the workforce, it can be a narrow group, it can be an extremely, extremely broad group. So what we sort of said instead was, look, what this is about is acknowledging that schools and programs of public health have a responsibility. We are the only academic institutions ostensibly with the capacity to train the workforce in public health, and we need to say that. We decided to focus on the public part of the workforce, because that we believe is a clear area for us. And then in that discussion, even though we tried to keep the focus on the post-professional training, it was impossible to not also speak about the fact that what we really need to continue to build is good, robust collaborations between the practice community and the academic community in all aspects of training, learning, research, community engagement, all those things, in addition to ongoing professional development and training. So we also then talked about the fact that there is now FAB, so we wanted the accrediting board to perhaps enhance its how it views this area. At the same time, we encourage CEEF to continue to include this. And then again, we talked a lot about how, as agencies and programs come together, it needs to be about high quality training that meets the needs of the practice. And it was easy. As I said, we used the earlier reports, the model that we had used. And we also had, we were able to draw upon new information that sort of came in as we were conducting this work. One was the Public Health WINS effort out of ASTHO, and then the job task analysis that had been conducted by the NBPHE. And then in particular, we look back at what our employers said they wanted in the workforce. We looked at what the MPH panel had said, and we looked at the council, because those competencies are clearly workforce competencies. I'm not going to go over this. I'm just going to put this up here because I know it will be discussed in a moment, but I just show it to you, and you'll see this again, just to show how these all lined up. So when we looked at what the job task analysis said, what we looked at what the council's competencies said, what we looked at what employers said, what we looked at what the MPH said, they all aligned. And so when we laid out content areas that we thought would be important for schools and programs in partnership with their practice colleagues, these were the topical areas. And these are things that you should not be strange. These are the areas of public health practice and the areas that we think we should be engaging in for further development. So as I said, the task force concluded its work in March of 2015, though the work continues. I'm still doing town halls, so if I have a microphone in an audience, I will come, because this is really about the conversation, and so continuing the conversation is important, and I think we will be continuing it for years to come. There are some committees within ASPPH that are using these reports to frame their work plans, and in particular the practice committee is looking at this report for how it might frame its work. And the annual meeting that we now have in March every year, we're trying to find ways to keep the partnership that was enhanced through this work through the local and state partners, so that we can keep these organizations in conversation as we continue this work. You'll hear it in a moment about CEIF and the things that it's considering for the future. But ultimately, to me, it's really about what each of us decides we need and want to do. So as schools and programs, as we evolve to meet the needs of the future, as we consider what our role is in continuing to prepare the workforce, as the workforce seeks us as partners, this is all about what we choose to do. And so I'm really hopeful. You've got a copy of the report. There's a lot in it for a brief report. You've also got a link to the website where all the reports are, and I think you'll see a lot of confluence across those reports. So I encourage you to go there. I encourage you to share your thoughts on this, and I've also put my email there. If you ever have any questions or want to invite me somewhere, I'm happy to come. So thanks. I will turn it over to Laura.
Good morning, everybody. I'm so glad that there are so many people interested in this topic. It's really important work, and I feel like it's kind of coming together, and this is a great session to highlight how a lot of the efforts that are going on kind of simultaneously are linking, and that's really critical for the future of public health. So I'm going to actually talk about two different initiatives. Initially, they asked me to be on the panel to talk about my own organization, which is the Council on Education for Public Health. But I said, oh, can't I also talk about this other thing? So they said, okay, you could talk about that too. So I'm going to talk about two completely different things. These are unrelated. So I really wanted, I even had blank slides, not with my own, you know, organization's logo, because they are different organizations. So the first one I want to talk about is an initiative that came out of the National Board of Public Health Examiners, and full disclosure, I sit on that board, and that is the organization that that does the credential, the CPH credential, Certified in Public Health. I'm sure some of you have heard of that. And what they did is something that has never been done in public health before, which is super exciting for us. They did a job task analysis. And what that is basically assessing the workforce, the public health workforce, and you all know how hard it is to even define what that means, but assessing the public health workforce broadly to see what are the tasks, what are the skills, what are the things that they actually do on a day-to-day basis in their jobs. And this is not limited to the governmental public health workforce. This was broadly. This was, we had representation, incredible representation from nonprofit sector, from pharmaceuticals, healthcare. A lot of graduates work in academic health centers. So not as, faculty, but as in research kind of capacity. The consulting firms, so Deloitte, Chemonix, those kinds of firms. So we looked broadly across all of those. So what they did is they gathered together a steering committee, and there were maybe three or four academics, but it was really mostly practitioners around the table from all of the different sectors of public health and where public health graduates go to work. Worked with a psychometric firm so that the analysis was done in a statistically valid way. What we did is we took basically all of the literature in recent history that's been written about what kinds of competencies and skills, including the Council on Linkages competencies, took all of those and kind of put them together and the steering committee looked for the cross-cutting skills that people who work in public health need, whether they work for a consulting firm or a pharmaceutical company, or whether they work in a local health department. What are those cross-cutting things that everybody needs to know and do? And so we took all of those, and we ended up getting it down to 200 tasks that we worked out in this group, and in about in 10 domains. Distributed very, very broadly. It was an internet-based survey. If any of you took it, you know that it took a long time. This was not for the faint of heart. It took probably 45 minutes to really fill out the survey, and we had a lot of people who persisted, which tells me that people really are anxious to know about this information. We ended up with about 7,500, 7,800 people who started the survey, and we ended up with about 5,000, just over 5,000 usable responses. 50% of those respondents had an MPH, 70% of them were at the master's level, 20% were at the doctoral level, and 10% were some kind of other. So perhaps no degree, perhaps a baccalaureate degree, but working in public health. And it was not limited to those with an MPH, but that was just how the distribution fell out. But what ended up happening is we got a very solid look at what MPH graduates are doing in the workforce, which is something that we have not really had before. So this data set is very, very rich. They rated the tasks on frequency, so do I do this? And if I do this, how important is this task to my job? So while I'm not going to go into the details of all of that, there are long, long presentations giving you all kinds of distributions and breakdowns, and it's very, very interesting. That is one initiative that has been happening and been kind of folded into this next initiative that I want to talk about, which is the accreditation criteria. So we accredit schools and programs in public health for degree levels from the baccalaureate level through the doctoral level. Our last major criteria revision was back in 2005. We've done some tweaks since then, but really 2005 was the last major one with major change differences that needed to be made in the schools and programs. We were sort of facing a lot of challenges at this point, and that's why we embarked on this at this time. A lot of which was changing landscape in higher education, but also kind of all of this framing the future work in public health. So the higher education landscape in general is changing, and then our field is kind of changing and coalescing around some ideas. So we, in the higher education landscape in general, as you know, probably the last 10, 15, maybe longer years, the Congress has been very focused on access. So making sure that everybody has access to higher education. In a systems framework, right, this kind of led to some positive outcomes and maybe some not so positive outcomes in terms of quality in general. More recently, really the focus has turned in the Congress from access to cost. So there's a lot, and the cost of higher education and the burden on taxpayers, all of that. So we're looking for around those issues. And also transparency. So there's a need for the public to understand what we are doing in quality assurance so that they understand how to make good decisions for their families and the students. Growth in public health higher education. I can't even tell you how much I'm really work in the accredited realm, or those who are trying to become accredited. Those are really kind of the small piece that I take on. But the growth in public health higher education is unbelievable. So in about 10 years, our accredited schools and programs have almost doubled. And that's just on the accredited front. We currently accredit 167 schools and programs, but we have 50 in the applicant queue. And what that means to us, those are official accepted applicants, and that means within the next 2 years, we'll have another 50 on top of that. So the growth really, it keeps on coming. It's somewhat at the master's level, but it's also very strongly at the baccalaureate level. And that's really where the education in public health is expanding. And of course, what that means is those programs, as they expand, need faculty who are trained in public health, so that creates demand at the graduate level. So it's been an incredible growth period. And we're also really looking at outcomes versus inputs. And that kind of gets back to the overall discussion about cost and more cost than access, but we're looking at the training. So does it really matter about the butt in seat time, or does it really matter what the student can actually do when they get out into the workforce? And that's really what we're trying to pursue. Our goals for the criteria revision, number one, ensure quality. That's first and foremost, always our goal is to ensure quality. We also want to allow opportunity for flexibility and innovation. The public health workforce is very, very broad. They work in all kinds of settings. Almost every issue could use a public health perspective to lay on top of it. So it's not just sort of the traditional public health workforce and solely public health jobs. It's kind of public health in all policies and all professions. And so we want to allow that flexibility and innovation for development of programs that address needs of communities within those communities. We're also looking to simplify and reduce burden. There's no need to report on things that aren't absolutely necessary. So what we've done in this next round of criteria revisions that we're working through now, we have essentially looked at every single requirement, every single standard, every single documentation request, and we've said, is this really necessary? Is this a need to know or a nice to know? And we've really broken it down to those things that are need to know for quality. And so that has been our focus. We have had a draft curriculum, curricular criteria. We started there that was released early in 2015. The reason we released that is because we had it done first. We sort of bit off the curriculum piece of the criteria first, knowing that we would need several iterations on that because there is a large curricular change in the works. And I'm at a bit of an awkward time here because we received comments last week. We met with our board, we received comments several weeks ago, but met with our board last week. They have since done a second draft of the criteria, and it will be released by a week from today. So it's kind of in the final edit stages. But and the comments are due January 8th. That's our next comment period. There will definitely be another comment period after that, and likely two. So we really want to work on this until we get it right. So we encourage you, please go after the week is up. Go to that web link that I provided, and that's where the new draft criteria will be released. Especially if you are a practitioner, we want to hear from practice because you are consuming essentially our product. So I'm going to give you kind of where these things tie together. This is very similar to the table that Donna showed. And you can see sort of down the left-hand side, the R draft domains, Okay, so there are competencies under each of those domains, but those are the domain areas that will be released in the next week or so. I'm giving you a little sneak preview. I redid this chart based on our discussions last week. So these are going to be the domains. And then it shows you kind of across the Council on Linkages domains. It shows you the Framing the Future Employers panel domains, which is what Donna was talking about, the Framing the Future MPH report. And these are the MPH domains, I'm sorry, just to be clear. This is not baccalaureate or doctoral. And then also on the other side, the NBPHE, the job task analysis, which I just spoke about earlier. But it shows you really how all of these efforts that have happened really sort of independently, in a sense. I mean, a lot of overlap in the people sometimes serving on committees and things, but these efforts going on independently are really coalescing around a group of domains that everyone can agree are what people need in all sectors of the public health workforce. So I think we're finally getting somewhere with this. I'm really excited about it. And I do hope that you'll take a look at the job task analysis, longer presentations that are they're on the web. And also please comment on the draft criteria. So thank you so much. And there's my information if you, and NBPHE's information, and happy to take emails from you.
Good morning. I've already had enough coffee and exercise finding the room. So I'm Ed Hunter. I want to talk a little bit about some very relevant things that the De Beaumont Foundation is working on. I think as Bill, in introducing me, noted my history at the federal level and working with developing strategies for programs and part of it for the last decade or more, trying to explain public health and attract interest and resources from the Hill, which was always at the 30,000 foot level, though I got to work with a lot of programs across a lot of domains and topic areas. You were always sort of trying, you were trying to work at the broad level to generate interest. And one of the things that was really exciting for me about joining the De Beaumont Foundation in February was the opportunity to work on a really practical level on some of these issues that you could see from that broader level were really underdeveloped and underattended. So at De Beaumont, we really work uniquely a focus on the practice of public health at the governmental, state, and local level in particular, trying to build the infrastructure and the capabilities, the tools, the technologies, the workforce, the approaches, the data systems at the state and local level to try to connect public health to a broader set of sectors, the healthcare system, other sectors in the health and all policies world that is the focus of the APHA meeting this week, and also to try to make the argument and the case for public health and some of my same history in trying to attract interest and resources. So you can't work on any of those without really recognizing the centrality of workforce. The public health is more about people than it is about money and contracting. It's about it's about our people, and so that all roads really lead to resources, to the support, the capability, the practicality of what do you do about the workforce, both the current workforce and the projected workforce. One of the things I was really fortunate to be able to work on soon after arriving at De Beaumont was this journal supplement, which just came out in the last couple of weeks. You can see it at their booth, at our booth, and in the exhibit area. It's online. All the articles are free access online, so you can go to the JPHMP website and read them all. It really is, it's a great collaboration between our foundation and ASTO. Really reflects a lot of work by champions we had in all the states that participated to encourage staff participation. 23,000 people were surveyed, 11,000 people responded. That's a lot of interest in trying to help identify what the workforce is about and what it needs. And we had 15 authors for the supplement that have mined the data to the extent it has been mined to date, but it's still a lot of things that are left to be researched and analyzed and used. So what did we find? This is actually a word cloud of all the words that were in all the abstracts that are part of this article. So you can at a glance kind of see it's about satisfaction, it's about job skills, it's about training needs, it's about workforce development, it's about pay, it's about a lot of different things. And so there's a lot of really interesting things in the supplement. We pulled out a number of these, and this is an infographic that you can get at the De Beaumont booth, or from Kate and Catherine who are sitting there, have some copies with it. It's really the public health workforce as it stands now, as told by the public health workforce. So we have a lot of publications and articles about what leaders in the public health field think, or thought leaders. This is actually drawn directly from what the workforce is telling us in 8 or 10 clear when you have it in your hand than on the screen probably, but I wanted to show you a couple of really key findings. This one, I think, you know, if we've been talking about what is academic training and what are standards and capabilities that we need academic training around, this is the call for why we need that. This is the urgency behind any effort to develop training in the workforce. We are facing a brain drain, a turnover, a churning. It's not all bad, because we all know we need new skills and new talent and new thinking in public health. But the daunting task of what do you do with them, how do you train them, how do you mainstream them into the public health workforce, where are they coming from, what gaps are we experiencing already, and then what gaps will we have going forward. So this gives you a little bit of the sense of urgency behind not only are we losing public health staff generally, but we're facing, you know, potentially large turnover, not only of retirement eligible people, which you expect, and we know public health is an aging field, but we're looking at millennials and others that are younger in the workforce who are also telling us they're not going to be in governmental public health in 5 years. Now, maybe that's expected, because millennials don't stay in, you know, if you ask any millennial where you're going to be in 5 years, it'll be probably somewhere different than they're going to be. But that's part of our shifting our mentality from a workforce that starts in public health at age 20, 25, stays in public health for 10 or 20, 30 years, and like I did, you know, retired from a governmental public health agency. It's not the workforce that we're facing. We're facing younger people who have different needs, different expectations in the workforce. And I think there's a lot in the supplement that speaks to what it takes to rethink our approach to retaining and attracting the right talent, in addition to training them in the pipeline that comes forward from academic training and the training in place. This one tells you a little bit about what the workforce itself told us, their training, their sense of importance about what skills they need and have, and whether they're equipped to deal with the things that they think are important. And because that's really small, I'll express to still fairly small now that I look at it, but a little bit bigger. So I think these are some really key things that the workforce itself is telling us, influencing policy development, understanding how policy affects public health problems and what they do, you know, things, how do you prepare a budget, how do you manage a program, how do you justify a budget, and then where does quality improvement fit into the current thinking. So the thing that strikes you is these are not, you know, if we'd only asked public health leaders or people that were in state health officer positions, these are probably what they would have said about their workforce. There's a couple of kind of strange disconnects. We also had public health workers tell us they thought they were that communications was pretty important. They were pretty good at it. Maybe they don't know what they don't know. I mean, there's some areas where you can look at this and say, gee, we're not as a field great in communicating what we do and why it's important. But by and large, I think this is sort of an action call for things that we know both leaders and public health workforce think are important. So we're working at the foundation to try to work with the public health community to address some of the things we found in the survey and in other convenings and work we've done with public health leaders. We really are focused on, because we're not all encompassing and large, we really focused on cross-cutting skills, not, you know, epidemiology training or lab training, but which we think others do well and should do well, But really the cross-cutting things, management and finance, we convened a lot of thought leaders in the field around what do we do to teach public health people about management and finance. We really find systematically we don't administer budgets well. We don't ask for budgets well. We can't spend money. As a federal official, I was always frustrated. We'd push money out in a hurry for Ebola or HIV or whatever the situation was, preparedness, and it doesn't get spent. We didn't get requested in the right way. The administrative systems were, you know, so there's a lot of management and finance things that I think would make us better as a field. Informatics, clearly, the workforce survey shows us that there's a very, very tiny proportion of the workforce that considers themselves doing informatics. But somebody's doing the information systems. They don't necessarily have the training and the skills that they need, so we're really working a lot on that. Things we learned from the survey on workforce policy, we certainly looked, and if you look at the articles in the supplement, there's a lot of factors in satisfaction that workers are telling us are issues. They don't find that they work in organizations that are innovative or that support new thinking or change, and this is something that younger workers really expect. So it's not just a matter of training them in specific things, but it's changing the way the workplace environment encourages work or rewards work. It's how we mentor younger staff who are coming up through the ranks who are going to have to replace that large number of people who are retiring or leaving. How are we training them? How are we bringing them into, these are the things I was particularly focused on in the editorial I did in the journal supplement, because these are not simple solutions. They're not just put in a new course. There's not just a form of new distance learning capability. These are actually part of the way we operate as agencies. So we're working on some initiatives to try to build on what we learned in WINS to develop more community practice across health departments. How do we refine training and needs assessment? How do we work with the existing resources in the field to make sure people know what good training looks like and how they access it? And then finally, I think some things that are implied in the workplace environment about what do we do with leadership training and workforce, how that relates to workforce policies. Many of you recognize your own acronyms or logos on this. If you don't know, if you're not part of some organization with the logo on here, you probably just are part of an organization that doesn't have a logo. So we use some words at the bottom to capture the rest. But many of you have been involved in the consortium, and it's a really important effort to bring the field together to try to help us on some of these cross-cutting priorities. There's a session tomorrow, I think at 8:30, that is about the consortium and some of the thinking that's gone into that. I'll just note the, in continuing the theme of the confluence of all these different groups that, the great minds that are thinking alike, these are the cross-cutting priorities identified by the National Consortium. Many of them, if you went back to the either of the matrices that were shown earlier, these are the same basic themes. And I think one of the things that strikes me in looking across the foundational capabilities, the core competencies, the cross-cutting priorities, all of the different columns you can fill in, I actually have a spreadsheet where I took not only those that were in the matrix, but I started adding all these other ones. Well, management, some of these same things come across all of them. So it's partly great minds thinking alike, but I think as was noted earlier, they're some of the same minds. So there's a lot of cross-contamination here in the thinking, but I think it's mutually reinforcing of some of these cross-cutting priorities that the consortium is looking at, some of the things that the employees told us in the WIN survey about their perception of need, some of the things the leadership is telling us, some of the things the academic convenings around these things have shown us, is we're all talking about the same small number of things, and the question of what do we do next and how do we come together as a field to actually address them. This is how you find us. You can get a copy of the infographics. You can see the journal supplement at our booth, or get a copy here, and those are other ways to find it. So thank you.
Thank you to all of our speakers. We're come now to the question and discussion time period today, so I hope you are thinking about questions. I thought I might ask one or two to get us started here, but please raise your hand as we go on. And we don't have a mic to pass back and forth, so you're going to have to move. I don't think...
No.
Okay. Nice try, but I look, there's nothing hooked to it. So we'll just have to pass back and forth or really shout. But I wonder, since the core competencies are used in so many ways and by so many organizations, I wonder if you could just emphasize for us a little bit how the initiatives each of you described really use and benefit from the core competencies themselves. Do you mind just one of you? All of you?
Well, I think, as Bill said, I think the core competencies.
Can you hear?
Can you hear me?
Yeah. 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 Okay.
I think yours were the first, right? I'm trying to think back. So it was sort of the first time that someone attempted to say, this is what we think public health professionals should know and be able to do, which was a really important sort of move ahead. And I think it really set the stage then for the rest of us to start thinking about what that meant for us. As you said, Steve reported, and in the old criteria, school departments were asked to tell us what the competencies were around each of their programs, and a lot of them drew upon those because they were there, and they made sense, and they were created by a group of people who are in the field. I think the fact that they've evolved, and a lot of us, our thinking has evolved, has been very, very, very important. And I think what's marvelous about today, as I think we've all said, is this confluence. Where before we used to be somewhat apart and there wasn't agreement and people would argue about, well, you know, that's for the workforce, that's not for academics, you know, it's not for us. We're all here, I hope, to do the same thing. So I think it's been a really important effort and I'm glad it's continuing.
Yeah, absolutely. And Donna brought up what I was going to mention, which is that in the past, the academic programs have developed their own competencies. And I would say, yeah, absolutely, most of them look at the core competencies as part, not necessarily to use sort of carte blanche because they're written for a different purpose, but definitely have drawn on those to create their own competencies for their academic programs. Now that we're moving into the criteria revision where we are going to specify what those core competencies should be across the board, we not only drew from those very heavily, we looked at them as we were beginning to think about domains and then looked through them as we're thinking about language to use. We looked at other efforts too, which had also drawn on them. So, I think we've definitely used them a lot. And then, of course, in the job path analysis, yeah, they were, all of them were included in that initial list that we looked at and said, you know, which ones of these, and actually most of them do, but which ones of these cut across all different work settings that public health workers are in. So we absolutely use them.
Yeah, I'll just add the importance, I think, not just of today, but of the history of getting to where we are today, is that public health training, when I was a kid, was about a discipline and about most of the discussion was around the academic side as opposed to the functional implementation side of the programs. And I think the core competencies effort, echoed now by other very similar things as we've seen in the matrix, I think has really called attention to the non-discipline side, the breaking the silos, the emphasizing the cross-cutting. So I think it's actually helped us get to the point where some real gaps in fundamentals of how we operate as agencies, I'm speaking from a governmental perspective, and how we actually can have the capability to be sustained as agencies and be effective as agencies and be good advocates for our programs and make connections with others. These are all skills that I think that the development of competencies has really helped bring to the forefront. And they're all things, if I measure the priorities that I have at Belmont on workforce, they are very much mirroring the categories of the competencies. And so I think it's really, the best thing I think it's done is help coalesce the field around things that are non-disciplinary but really, really essential to success.
Yes, questions from all of you? That's one in the back. Shout it out, if you would.
Okay, can you hear me? So first of all, thank you so much for the actual organization representing for doing this work, which is so important, and I think that it is very, very good contribution to the public health community as a whole. So what I have heard today is that there are additional skills that I need for the public health workers. That includes all the cross-cutting issues that I heard, but the program pain and management and finance, quality improvement for the problem solving and so on. And I agree with that. I think that that is what you compare, and I think that that's accurate. From the cultural implications for public health perspective, how are we planning to accommodate that to the schools? Because there is only a given number of credits that are available for a master's program. And then, so basically what we are confronted with at this moment is that we have to train professionals in so many disciplines, but there is still the same 42 or whatever many credits. And if one school decides to offer a program with like 48 or 50 credits, then the students are going to go to the one that's offering 42 only. So what is the guidance and what is the flexibility that schools and programs are going to have to achieve the goals of the new trends of skills that people need, and at the same time need the conditions of the council and education for public health?
So I'll start. I think I'm not saying you're thinking this, but I think there's been a bit of a misunderstanding that what's being proposed here is additive. What's being proposed here is transformative. So how do we take all the wealth of knowledge and experience and skills we have in the faculty, in our partnerships, all of those things, and rethink how we help students develop foundational skills, core competencies, okay? So you will see words, you've seen all these words, you don't see biostatistics, environmental health, but the concepts are in there. So it really is incumbent upon us, this is my last comment, we all have to decide how we're going to embrace it. And in the conversations I've had, and Laura always reminds me, it's where I've been invited, I understand that. So where I've been invited, the conversations have been very positive, very enthusiastic, people are eager to sort of tear apart what they've had and rebuild, okay? And emphasize these new areas. So you can still learn basic epidemiology, but if you learn it in the context of how you assess needs and develop a program and evaluate, right, you're still learning basic epi, but you're also learning it in its application context. So there are a number of schools and programs that have already gone down this path and are doing it successfully, and I'm hoping that we will continue to hear from those models so we can all learn from that. But that's really what this is about. The other thing I would say, and I appreciate the point, it's something that we all get nervous about, but I think if you're offering a really quality program, students will take a few extra credit hours if that's what you feel is needed to maintain the integrity of what you're trying to do. So just in my own school, we have MPHs from 45, I think is the minimum, up to 60, and students choose what they want. So it's a concern, but I've been accounted to be. But I would also say, I think if you start rethinking how you deliver content and skill, I'm all about why does everything have to be a three-credit course, this is the new thing we're doing in my school, you can slice and dice it in very different ways. And the more you get your students out into the community, which doesn't have to be credit-bearing, you also can start to build skills and how they are applied. Does that make sense?
No, the only other thing I want to add is, looking at what Ed was presenting, it's hard, and it will be hard, and there will be teeth gnashing, and it will be hard. Change is hard. But you know what? We have to do it. We are at a point where we can't just not do it. It has to be done.
And it is transformative, and it's scary, and it's hard, and some people will go and be excited about it, and other people will be, you know, like a dog that is like this, and they don't want to go outside and turn it will be like that for some, but I don't think we have a choice for the sake of the public health. And so,
I'll just add, too, that I think when I think of the competencies or even the attributes I would want, you know, the next PH WIN survey, did the workforce feel better about their own capabilities and skills? Some of it, in thinking from the inside of the health agency as opposed from the academic institution trying to generate the workforce that in the pipeline, there's a cluster of opportunities to learn these things. I think it starts, you know, and 17% of the public health workforce has a degree from has a public health degree, which means 83% don't. So they're getting their experience education somewhere else. I would love to think that people coming out of the School of Public Health or a program would have these skills, would at least would know these are important skills for them to acquire. So they may not acquire it in the classroom, but they might acquire it through an internship. When I went to CDC, I used to have one or two interns all the time. Some came out of public health school, some came out somewhere else, public policy school. But they were all given some exposure to things they didn't get in an academic setting. And a lot of the reaction was usually, wow, I didn't really know that how it really worked. So there's capabilities that are acquired from academics. But academia can at least train people that these are the things you're going to have to know to be successful. You may not get them all here in the classroom, but do an internship, do a work study, get out in the community, as was mentioned. And this is a lifetime learning experience, so you probably aren't ever done with developing your core capabilities, but you have to start somewhere, and the schools, I think, can give the people that broader framework of this is what you need beyond your discipline to be successful. Mm-hmm.
Good. Yes, ma'am, here.
Thank you for that segue. I represent local public health, and so I'm looking for those opportunities for application within the folks who are still in our public health department. They'll reach you when you see the population, people leaving us. I found two areas that I think are very hopeful for this cross-cutting learning. First is the QI opportunities, and the second is evaluation. I wonder if you have found that those two areas are helpful, and if you know of any other areas where local health departments can merge their silos and merge with other bureaus within the department.
I don't have great concrete examples. There may be others that do, but I do think there's a growing recognition, particularly in larger health departments. I mean, it's really hard for many of our health departments that have 10 staff to think about cross-fertilizing training or to learn from each other or worry about the health department that's next door that they can potentially share services or experience with. But I think in bigger cities and other areas, I think that's exactly the kind of learning we want to do. I want to make one comment on, you talked about the out-migration of people from public health and from local public health. One of the things I think is really a loss for us is they're all going somewhere, and they're all doing, many of them are doing public health work, they're just not doing it in a local health department or a state health department. So where are they going? I mean, and what are we doing with them while they're in local public health? So if they come and they're the average millennial and they work 3 to 5 years in a local public health department, what are we teaching them while they're there that they can take to the health plan or to the pharmaceutical company and do something with that's to the benefit of population health or our view of public health? So that's one of the things, you know, we should be thinking of their work in public health for those however many years as part of this learning curve that is generating the workforce with an attitude about public health that they're going to want to come back and partner with public health. So that's only partially answered your question, but it's
just one comment. The expert panel that I spoke about had a dream, and the dream is as the number of accredited schools and programs grows, there is more possibility that you, wherever you are in a local health department or state health department, will have an accredited school or program near you. And that wasn't the case when I was in school. Okay? So as that happens, there should be, and I think we talked about it a little bit, there should be much more collaboration, cross-collaboration, so that if you need skills development in those areas, our students certainly need skills development, and maybe there's a project they can work on with your staff so that you not only accomplish something, but everybody learns together. And so that's really the dream. It's not, you know, who has to do this, who has to do this. It's what are the opportunities that we all gain from. So that's a hope. I don't know, it's not reality yet, but that is a hope.
Okay. In the basket?
Sure. I completely change of, I represent a program, a public college, a master's program, an undergraduate program. These changes are transformative and will involve family and nursing achievement. And it takes time. What do you anticipate is the timeline for making inclusion criteria in effect? And we've got kind of thinking, you know, that you've got a health study coming up in 4 or 5 years, but where, you know, what the process.
Sure.
Where are we going to be talking more?
Right. That's a good question. And I assure you, that is the implementation process for new criteria is something that we will be working through with all of the schools and programs. It's not like we're doing it to you. We will work with you and get it done. And so it's a matter of an individualized letter for your own particular place to let you know when you'll be, you know, how it will affect you specifically. So beyond all those details. We expect adoption of the new criteria by the end of 2016. But there's always about a 2-year phase-in process just because of how procedures work. So we expect probably, and again, this is really sort of looking into the future, but probably 2018-ish would be like the first site visit, but then it does kind of depend on individual circumstances. But yes, if you are from a school or program, please don't stress. We will be working with you through it. It involves a lot of education and development and a really specific implementation timeline by people who also are subject to the changes. So we make sure that it's possible and not, you know, impossible for everyone to make the changes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So many of us, I'm from the School of Community Health Sciences. We have a burgeoning, I mean, huge undergraduate population. And I know that, you know, many of the skills that you talked about are really that master's level and we're most familiar with those. So I think we're challenged to really capture this very large undergraduate population. Any thought about ways we might want to look at skills we should really be implementing in our undergraduates so they have a way out? Hopefully they'll want to learn more, but our MA programs are not very big and our undergraduates are huge.
Yeah, we've just started, have you taken a look at the standalone baccalaureate program?
Yes.
So those
are self-studying requirements.
Yeah. So those standards are out there as well. Those are like unlikely to change, if anything tweaks, but really not at all, because we're trying to bring everybody up into those baccalaureate standards. I have to say, I have been absolutely blown away by some of the undergraduate public health programs. They really are doing a fantastic job in training some of the skills that, even some of the skills that are at the master's level. But it's also kind of a different kind of training. So I think the articulation is hard. That's something that we're still sort of working on. But I do think that when we move the MPH into a different kind of framework, I think it will be kind of a natural progression, not necessarily from the baccalaureate into the MPH, because just from the baccalaureate into the workforce, from the baccalaureate into other health professions. But I think I've been really impressed with what they're doing, and I think there's a real benefit there to
the workforce and to, you know, the health of the public just by what they're producing. So I don't know if that answers your question, but
are you coming to the undergraduate network meeting?
Yes.
We'll talk more.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I want to follow up with my colleague, the local health department over there. I'm also an administrator of the local health department, chair of my state conference of local health officials. There was kind of passing mention of discussions with public health accreditation board, and since that is the structure that state and locals are hanging all of our quality improvement efforts on, I'd like a little more detail on alignment of this process with the developing FAB standards and metrics. I want to also just real quickly reflect back to an earlier comment about small health departments and kind of the emphasis of this effort on large. And I come from Oregon. Our third health department that was accredited in the state has a total workforce of 17. It is tiny. They are dedicated to quality improvement and workforce development. Please don't discount the power and the need for that. Small rural jurisdictions are where some of the largest health inequities and worst health indicators exist. And so the need for that workforce development, the need for quality improvement in those departments is often even greater, as great as in large department interested areas.
Yay!
Yeah.
So on FAB, just say real quickly, standard 8, I think it is, your workforce or whatever, right? Am I right? Standard 8. And it's pretty broad right now. It's not very specific. So I met with the Public Health Accreditation Board in Rochester and went over what I just shared here. And they liked that because, again, it looked nice. It looked just like what the Council for Conferences looked like. It looked just like the Job Back Council. It looked just like the Public Health. So they were going to work on it. I don't know where they are. I'm not on the bench.
I guess my point is bringing a workforce in, a developing workforce in, that's familiar with that. Where that is the key component of academic training.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, Ron? If they mentioned the relationship between FAB and the core competencies of more professional as well, and that we work very closely with FAB on that problem that we have domain aid and observed on the workforce development. And then also something I want to mention related to this is domain, I guess, 10, which has the relationships piece. And we talked a great deal with that about the academic health department concept, where you have academia and practice working together to build the confidence, not only the skills, but also working together, service, research, et cetera. And just as a concept, actually did a webinar, the academic health department, where we're going to be talking about how these relationships can help the health departments, help the academic institutions, all the sort of elevate. And if you're interested in that webinar, it's actually our time.
Yes, go in the back.
Hi, good morning. My name is Andy Lindsay. I'm the director of an interprofessional workforce development program at the Washington University of D.C. Many of our students that come through our program are not actually finding themselves being placed in traditional public health careers. Many of them are going into consulting and other places where they struggle just to define what public health is supposed to do in those sectors, but they get hired for those jobs anyway because of the burden of skills they bring to the table. So I'm wondering, I've heard a lot about the competencies and as it relates, especially to young people that are going into traditional health careers, but how, could you all teach us a little bit more about how you were tracking your students to go into non-traditional health spaces, especially how we're tracking their capacity to not only talk about what public health is and what they can do, but also understand the role of others and the intersection of public health with those jobs.
all acknowledge what you just said. You know, we train students, they go everywhere. I've often said that even though we might argue about whether we're training them right or wrong, whether there's good things or bad things, they get jobs and those agencies appreciate the skills that they have. But on your other point, I think the reason we created that Blue Ribbon Employer Advisory Group for the Training Future Task Force was for that very reason, and we wanted to make sure that we were hearing from all the different types of employers, and that's all on the web, the HPPH website. You can see who they were, where they came from. And it didn't matter. It really didn't matter where they were. They said the same thing. The same things that we see are what they said. So it didn't matter if they were in defense, if they were in the drug company world, if they were in community health organizations. They all said the same thing. And the other thing I would ask you to look at, or suggest that you look at, is the population health across all professions report, because that gets at, or I think it's trying to get at, your question. So no matter where you go, how do you, you know, sort of apply the public health perspective, and how do you advocate for a public health approach wherever you are, and vice versa. If you're in those other professions and you're not trying to public health, how do you contribute? So that's all in those reports. If you have a quiet afternoon, pull them out or not. They're not long, but it's all there. And I think at the point that we acknowledge, and I think what you might also be suggesting that I hadn't thought about, is how do we maybe expose our students more deliberately to the breadth of not just for here's where you may find a job, but here's the kind of work you may be doing and how does that connect back. So thank you, that's really important.
Yes.
Yeah.
From a public health academia perspective, I'm really gratified that all these organizations have come together and given us a roadmap to say these are the standards that our public health graduates should know. My question is, what is the next step for all of these organizations? Is it, for example, putting together examples of opportunities, like Donna said, you know, partnerships with academia and practice, or, you know, or as Ron suggested as well? Or is it some kind of evaluation? You know, do these competencies really link to these particular outcomes that we want? Or building a toolkit, or, you know, set of tools like the Council of Linkages? What's the next step?
That's a great question. Some of the notes I'm kind of making on my notepad here. That dawned on me as we're talking. We've been so focused on the current stuff that we are going to shift from sort of current step mode to helping in our little segment of the world where we influence, shifting into implementation and technical assistance mode. And we are already starting to think about some of the ways that we can provide that technical assistance. The other thing that I've been doing is meeting with other organizations while I've been here, and they're asking those questions. You know, what are the next steps? How can we help you? What tools do you think would be useful for us to help provide? And I think there will be a role for everybody, because this really is transformative. But I think you're right. I think we need to start to move into that next phase of so what, now what, and how to help move everybody along, because there will be a lot of moving that needs to happen.
This lady's in her hand up this week.
I have a follow-up to that question for those of us in academia, where because this is so transformative, we all know the forces that really prevent that from happening. But I'm not saying this as a critique. I really offer this as what I agree is a really important next step. We have to pay attention to what we teach and how we teach it. And I would love to see more, especially ASPPH, attention to that. You know, similar to what AAMC does in medical schools, they've done a tremendous amount, especially in areas like population health. So, and how are we going to get faculty hitting and screening to change the way they teach, you know, the course they've been teaching for the past 30 years? So I do see that as also a really critical next step if we want the system to actually work.
And can I just sort of mention that though academic training is really big part of this. I don't want to lose sight of the fact that we have a huge workforce and people that are on the escalator to management positions or leadership positions that lack some of these really essential skills. And there are things academia can do to help with that, and there are things we need to work on inside the workplace about that. But I think there's a lot of, we've focused on management and budget and finance as one example, informatics as another. There are things where if people come out of schools and go to work in governmental public health and they have those skills, great. But for the other ones, how do you engage academia in distance learning and quality e-learning? We have an initiative looking at what are the standards for e-learning, not just content, but not content, but actually the delivery mechanisms, and academia can really help with some of that. But there, you know, the public health workforce from a practical point of view is not primarily coming out of school. It would be better if they did, because they would have more of these skills. But for those that are already there or coming from somewhere else, we need to really engage academia and others in the practice community and helping the game.
You expand on that at all? I mean, what is there? So you said there is a discussion going on right now with the e-learning opportunity model, but you know, what kind of discussion is taking place with that?
So what the one practical example is, we have a project to convene people around what are quality standards for distance for the actual delivery of learning. So we would publish some standards that come out of that process that can then be used by public health organizations or others. It can be a component of training. It could be how do you then take the standard, apply it to existing e-learning or the development of new e-learning, and say these are quality courses, not just from a content point of view, where you're the professor or the source, but you wouldn't know if it's a good learning experience. And these can be used then to attract public health workforce to those courses that the leadership of their agency can look to a credible source, after NATO, you know, some other branded organization, some of the logos that show, and say these are the ones that we have taken or our people have taken that meet these standards that are important, that have a better chance of being worth the time that you're going to have to devote to that person to go off and do something. I think there's another set of things around, as an example, management and finance, where you can really try to build this into academic curriculum, but for people in the workforce, these are some pretty unique things that apply to the way they actually work in the field, and so we probably have to develop customized new training to make that happen.
Yes.
I represent part of the public health practice workforce that I think historically we would say we've been left behind. One of those standalone that Kurt spoke about laboratories resigned. And I think that the foundational work that is going to be transformative, I really truly believe that, is so essential. How do you see the discipline specific parts of public health engaging veterans? So I'll give you an example. We've developed on our own, collaboratively with CDC, core competencies. So we're on the analytics, and it's making sense, and it will transform the work that we're doing. But I don't see that translating yet into the academic community. And I know we have the early work with Donna School, which is really going to be probably one of the most exciting opportunities that we have to bring academia and practice, public health lab practice, together for many years. But what are some things that practice can do to get engaged on the discipline-specific side?
So I think in our case, we have a champion, right? An alum in the community on my advisory board, on your, you know, it's just the things that happen. But I think it's a good example of part of the disconnect where the academic institutions don't connect to their practice community, so that you miss it. So I don't know that my epidemiology department knows about the CSP competency. I don't know. They might. I hope they do. But they might not. And so I think it's sort of incumbent upon us to not be afraid to knock on each other's doors and say, you know, hey, there's this whole world out here. I mean, I think the issue talk about, I mean, there's some really good things written out there. We just have to get that to more people. But if we rely on luck, we will not get what we need. So I think we have to look for probable partners and knock on the door and say, how can we work together? But I don't think there's a lot of confidence there yet, but there needs to be. What do you think about?
Hi everybody. I'm a faculty at a full-time meeting, and I had going back to a couple comments about next steps and how to teach. I've been on the assessment committee for school pharmacy, and we've been doing a lot with professional education. So public health is definitely one of the professional education as these cross-cutting competency are. We're not so straightforward on how to assess. It's very difficult. When you're working with people with a background and skills-based, which is knowledge-based. So I guess my comment or question is, how do you see assessing going forward and making sure that we're actually we're getting what we're trying to teach them?
I think we're done. Recognize we're part of a learning community, and we just have to continue to strive. And I think you'll see in the new criteria coming out some thoughts about that, some proposals for that. We love feedback on is this going to work or not work. But I think, it's hard. So we're just going to have to keep working. This poor woman is better.
That's okay. I actually, we have several different hats that I want to follow up to discuss on it. My name is Linda Rosa, and I actually work for the Master Plan of Public Health. And thank you all. I thought this was fabulous. And thank you to Edward. I'm the past president of the Association for Public Health Nurses. So I represent at the national level and also at the state level public health nursing practice. But I can give a couple of good examples. And I'm happy to be Jen Soy here from Watson University School of Public Health. I'm an alum of the School of Public Health, and they are really good best practice on connecting with alumni and getting those linkages. So I work with them on distance learning. We work with the Mass Department of Public Health for internships, so that practice, academic partnership, really, really great example. Not to shout out to where I went to graduate school, but I think we've underlined the importance of that, especially for local public health. And my colleagues from Oregon, a lot of our local public health departments in Massachusetts are really small. We have 351 of them in Massachusetts. And it's a great way to be able to get them in, to get a student at a very small local health department and really see that connection and connect the competency. So thank you.
Yes, one more question.
In the beginning, you shared some tools and resources with the ethic. Is that through the Public Health Foundation? And I say that from a local level as federal agency, and I'm glad you asked the question about assessment. Long term, our assessment is this will help public health at the ground level, and that's what we're going to look for. So these tools and resources would help the local public health agency bring that 48-year-old average person up to a standard that's going to be. The activity and bring that. So, is there a way we can get our hands on the resources you provided on that slide here
for? Mm-hmm.
Is there a website, policy,
laws,
things of that
nature? Yeah, so any of the resources related to the core competencies of public health, anything about the top is all available on the PHF website. So, it's just phf.org. And I actually uploaded the slide to the AKHA's online system. So, if you go to the program, you should be able to get the slides and all the links interactively. I uploaded the handout, so not the recording of the session, but if you actually go into the program, the handout is supposed to appear there. It's just like a PDF. Or feel free, I think we have my email address in there somewhere. It's kamos@phf.org. Send me an email or give me a card, and I'll make sure to get it.
We have just a minute or two left, and I'm probably going to use that myself. I want to come back to the question from Dr. Lee, who asked, what comes next? Certainly for the Council on Linkages, it's developing tools, but it's also watching this environment, because we will be making decisions, of course, when we should try to revise these competencies again. And I'll remind you that we are in a new era, really, an era of health reform, an era of a time when medicine and public health in many ways are working more closely together. Certainly one of the issues we're thinking about is what sort of cross connection there is between primary care skills and public health skills. How is that all going to impact on what the future public health worker will be, who may very well, some of them will certainly find themselves in much broader kinds of public health work definitions than currently exist. So I think you're getting the sense that this is complicated, it's dynamic, but it's timely, and as the panelists said, this is not something that we should just look at and wish we should do, it's something we really have to do. And you should be prepared for continuing change. The change is going to continue, probably accelerate a little bit, and you don't want to be that dog that's reluctant to come outside and pulled along. You know, it's understandable that we would be reluctant to face this kind of change continuously because it is disconcerting. On the other hand, it's pretty exciting, and we have a chance to really help define how this profession is going to evolve as the culture in which we live evolves as well. So thank you all for being with us this morning. We appreciate your attendance and your participation, and please help me thank the panel for their participation.